Thank you very much, members, for your attendance. And we would like to thank also the Competition Tribunal a two-member tribunal for bearing with us. I think you've been here since this morning. I think it was also for your own benefit, so that you know what we want and you are able to zoom into the issues that we want them. Otherwise, let's not waste further time and allow you to present to us your strategic plan.
Chair members, thank you very much, and it's our pleasure to be here and to present our strategic plan. If I can just introduce myself, I'm Norman Manoyam, I'm the chairperson of the tribunal, and with me on my left is the head of our corporate affairs, Janine de Klerk, who, as part of her position, she's in charge of finance and compliance works, and she's here with me today. You've heard from the Commission fairly extensively on a number of issues this morning, so I'm going to try and be quite brief because I've covered a number of issues and a number of your questions which may overlap with us, and perhaps just focus specifically about where we are different to the Commission and have slightly different issues. Our Enabling Act is the Competition Act of 1998. We're established since 1999 as a new legislation. The strategic plan deals with the period 2010-11 to 2014-15, as you're aware. If I could perhaps start with the mission statement, and perhaps at this time to say what's the difference between what you do and the Commission do, and as we've said before to this committee, is that if you think of the Commission as the policeman and the prosecutor of the system, the tribunal is the court of the system. So we are there to hear the cases and decide whether people are guilty or not guilty, and if they're guilty, to decide on what sentence they should get. So that's, in a sense, what we do and why we have a fairly limited and modest role in the system, and are a much smaller organization than our Commission counterparts. That's why there were three of them this morning and just two of us this afternoon. Okay, now, because we're an adjudicative body, we need to be, from the constitutional requirements, that we are fair, we're objective, and we are independent. We try to make our decisions timeous and of a high caliber. Sometimes those two notions are in conflict with one another, because sometimes a very good decision takes more time, and sometimes a quick decision is of less weightiness. So what we try to do is balance the importance of that decision with the time that needs to get out. In other words, if we don't think the decision is terribly important or a precedent setting, we try to get it out as quickly as possible, and vice versa if we think it's going to be precedent making and therefore of important effects, not just to the parties involved but to other people involved. Effective communication with the public of our work. We do quite a lot to actually make sure that people know what our decisions are, know what our cases are about, and try and understand why we made the particular decision. And the final one is that it's courteous, efficient, informed interaction with our customers. In other words, we want people to phone up the tribunal offices and saying, what's happening with this particular merger, and come across somebody who can say to them, that merger is being held on the 10th of September, and that's where it is. In other words, they must, in a sense, get an intelligent response from an inquiry. It doesn't mean that because we are courteous, we're going to be kind. I just want to emphasize that the fact is we're an enforcement agency, and if we've got to find somebody, they may not find us very kind, but hopefully they will find that we are still courteous while we did that. That's our mission statement. If I can then move on to this slide just deals with the alignment of the tribunal's objectives with those of the Economic Development Department. And essentially, we align with certain of those objectives in relation to the effect that mergers, for instance, would have on small and medium enterprises. A proper competitive economy would ensure there's a greater spread of ownership. Taking into some of our objectives into account that may have a particular effect on the ownership of historically disadvantaged people. Promotion of employment comes up as a factor in merger control and sometimes a factor that we take into account in our public interest. The rest are, in a sense, the remaining objectives are competition-related objectives, and obviously to the extent that we are promoting competition, we're aligning ourselves with the objectives of the Economic Development Department to get a competitive economy. What are our outputs? Now, let me just pause on this particular slide, because you might find that our presentation here, our strategic plan, is a lot less illuminating than other people who presented for you. And there's a good reason for that, as I explained in our previous presentation earlier this year when we discussed the strategic plan. We are, because we're a court, we are reactive, we are not proactive. In other words, we couldn't say that we will stop 5 mergers this year and fine people R1 billion in a particular year. That would be wrong, because we'd be coming with an agenda to find a particular thing. So it limits our ability to be proactive, and that's why I say we are a reactive organization. People bring cases to us, and we decide those cases. If nobody brings any case to us that is one which we can make a finding, then that's what we must do. If nobody decides to merge, then we have no mergers. So we are a reactive organization in that sense, and that's actually fine. That's what we're there to be a court, not to be a player in the situation. And again, the reason is because we're adjudicators, not prosecutors. So prosecutions, like prosecuting bodies like the Commission, have an agenda. We do not have an agenda. Does that mean that we are sort of in our own little ivory tower, impervious to what's going on in the world? No, because we are actually affected by the Commission's agenda. So to the extent that you heard the Commission this morning identifying certain industries which they want to target, the Commission will set our agenda, because those will be the kinds of cases that we will hear. And the Commission is our biggest customer, so to speak. It determines most of the cases that come to us around prohibited practices, and it determines outcomes of investigations of mergers. So what the Commission is doing is hugely influential on how we deal with our matters. And to the extent the Commission has an agenda, we reactively have an agenda. But we're not only driven by the Commission. Private firms can bring complaints as well to us. The Commissioner mentioned this morning that sometimes, in a number of cases, they non-refer a prohibited practice complaint. When the Commission non-refers a prohibited practice complaint, that party can bring the matter to us directly, as they sometimes do. So firms themselves can also determine our agenda if they feel that they want to bring a case even the Commission has non-referred it. So the fact that a matter has not been referred by the Commission doesn't mean that the aggrieved party can't come along and bring a case, and they do from time to time with varying results. So firms themselves can still determine our agenda. Consumers can determine our agenda, and trade unions can also determine our agenda, because they get involved particularly in mergers around employment issues. Do we have no targets? No, we do have targets, and our targets are difficult to, in a sense, develop. So what we've done is to develop targets around our turnaround times. In other words, once the case has got to us, what are we doing with it, and how quickly are we doing with that? So we can't be responsible for how long it takes to get to us in the first place. That determines in the Commission, or it's been non-referred by the particular party that non-refers, that then brings it privately, or in the case of merger, when they decide to, they are ready to bring the merger. But when we have turnaround times, we have set our own targets for when we should do that. So I'm first going to deal with mergers. You recall what the Commission said this morning. We essentially deal with two different things in this competition legislation. We deal with mergers, and we deal with prohibited practices. Basically, that amounts to all the enforcement that we're doing. It falls into one of those two categories. Now, when we deal with the, as Shan Rambera said, we deal with, at the tribunal, with large mergers, and we deal with the intermediate mergers when there's an appeal against the Commission's decision. So in other words, our share of the merger pie, so to speak, is much smaller than that of the Commission's, but we deal with slightly larger cases when they come around. Now, our target is to SECDAL merges within 10 days of them being referred by the Commission. Now, you will notice with our targets that we have set an absolute 100% performance. That's probably not realistic because we don't hear 100% within 10 days. We hear a high percentage, but not 100%. And one of the issues that I want to talk to, and particularly when we discuss our quarterly report, is that what we don't have yet is the targets that go with these. In other words, the objective is 10 business days of referral to set it down. What should the target be? In other words, should it be 60% or 80% or 90% doing that? Because not all cases are set down within 10 days of referral, sometimes with no fault of us, because we phone the people up and saying, are you ready next Wednesday? You hear their case, and they say, no, the CEO is overseas, he's in Australia, he's coming back the following week, please set it down a week later. So we don't meet the 10-day target, but the very firm who wanted heard quickly is not available. So what we're trying to do, and we want to work with the ED on getting those figures right, is to say, this is the objective. What's your target figure to achieve that objective? We haven't worked that out yet. We hopefully will have them for, I would say that in 6 months' time we will be in position to do that. The way we want to get those figures is to model on our past. We've kept those statistics, and what we want to do is look at what is the meaningful statistic that is not either too easy to achieve or too difficult to achieve. So at the moment, you won't see those figures, and we need to develop those. But you will see the objective in these figures. The other objective is to get the order issued within 10 business days of the hearing. What do we mean by the order? The order is the outcome that whether the merger is approved conditionally, or prohibited. That we've got to bring out within 10 business days of the hearing. Again, we need to set a target for how many of them that we will do. And then the third intervention that we do is give reasons. In other words, frequently with mergers, the outcome precedes giving the reasons. So we'll say, merger is approved, but only later give the reasons for doing so. And the reason why we separate the order from the reasons is that merger activity is very time-driven. So once the people, most mergers are approved without conditions. You'll see during this period that 100% of the mergers we had were approved without conditions. The figure on average is around the high 90s. So in order to not to delay that activity, we give the order out first and give the reasons later. Otherwise, it will delay people implementing that merger because they're waiting for us before they get the green light. Because under the Competition Act, you can't implement a merger until such time you've got approval. So it would be illegal for them to implement the merger until we've given the approval. So hence, we get the orders out before the reasons are given. But we have to give reasons in each case. And so in order to prevent that prejudice to the firms, we divide the time periods up. The other business I said we do are prohibitive practices. And it starts off with something called a pre-hearing. When we have prohibitive practices, for those who might be sort of familiar with normal litigation, we have what is called an exchange of pleadings. The Commission brings a referral, which is like the summons, the starting document. The accused party files something called a answer, which is their responsive document, and the Commission can then file a reply. These are called the pleadings. It takes some months for those to be exchanged. When they have been exchanged, they advise us and they ask us for a pre-hearing. And so we will try to get the pre-hearings done, at least convened within that time period. Sometimes, again, the parties themselves may not be ready for the pre-hearing. Might be because they're even talking settlement. Might be because they can't get hold of their advocate and they ask for some extension. So this is sort of, again, a ballpark figure not written in stone. Then the next time period is, because we can't predict the time that the case has got to run, and we can't say to people, we're only giving you 5 days, otherwise say, well, you haven't allowed me to run my case properly. So the next time period that we can actually give is how long does it take to give our orders and reasons after the case is finished, and we set a period of 100 business days. Now, that sounds quite long. The reason it's quite long is that these are the most difficult cases, and so they take much longer to be considered than merger hearings, and because they are usually contested, there's a lot of information to go through in order to write those reasons. And 100 days is, from what we've said, from experience, is a reasonable figure. Some cases are obviously going to be under that, and some very rarely might even be above that period. Strategic focus for this period then is, again, like the Commission response to the amendments the Act had proclaimed, they may have implications for us, particularly if criminalisation comes in, it may affect how we run our proceedings. For instance, just to give you an example of how that might turn out, under the Act, at the moment, an accused person in a criminal cartel case is presumed to be, if we found that there was a cartel in our proceedings, it is presumed that there was a cartel unless the accused proves the opposite. Now, it might be, for instance, that an accused person might say in our proceeding, which will become before the criminal proceeding, I would like to be represented during the tribunal case because my criminal rights might be affected. I'm not sure how we're going to deal with that. Probably what we will do is when the first case comes around, we will ask various people to argue the legal points as to whether they are entitled to be represented in our case, and also ask the MPA to come along and argue how it feels we should deal with it. But if it emerges that we must allow them representation in our proceedings, it will have a much longer implication for our proceedings because we will have a whole room full of lawyers, not just the firms themselves, but the accused people who may have a difference of interest with their own firms, and it could be quite a prolonged proceeding. So that's a serious implication for us of criminalisation, which we will have to respond to at the appropriate time. The next thing is we are working at the moment on a document called Practice Guidelines. You've heard this morning and you've been concerned about why cases take a long time. One of the ways that we're trying to intervene to reduce this, and I don't want to be over-optimistic about that, but giving practice guidelines over issues that are not in our existing act or rules to practitioners based on our experience may be a way of trying to cut down the time periods. You might ask me what would be an example of that. Well, one of the examples might be to say, if you have a legal team represented and we want to set a case down and it's going to be set down within, say, 3 months of the pre-hearing, well, even if your advocates are not available at that time period, we will still set the matter down. If we have a guidelines beforehand, then people know what they're in for. So they can't complain if we suddenly change the rules afterwards. Because one of the biggest problems why these cases are taking so long is the availability of advocates and expert economists who come to this case. And although the Commission is not in this room, you know, it's their representation sometimes which could also equally hold up the proceedings, not just the respondent's legal representation. So that's the biggest cause when it comes to our end of the case of holding up proceedings. And the practice guidelines will hopefully try to address that, not perfectly, but in some way give guidance. The second benefit of the practice guidelines is it will allow people who are not familiar with our system to understand how it works. But the problem is at the moment we've got a small pool of practitioners who deal with in this area and know it very well. But for somebody who comes into their first case, it's a bit of a forbidding proceeding. We differ in quite a few ways from ordinary civil court proceedings, and this will help other people get into that area more comfortably, we hope. So it has two objectives. Then we are, related to this, is we are trying to work on a project, an access to justice project. And we have joined up with an organization called Pro Bono. And I'll talk to that later when I deal with the quarterly report. But basically, Pro Bono is an organization that marries clients with lawyers. And because of the imperative now on large law firms and advocates to do some pro bono work, what this organization does is says, here is a person who has a legal need, it has a whole bunch of lawyers and advocates on its roll, and those people agree to take up the case on that person's behalf pro amico, in other words, for free. So we've started talking to these people about taking on competition cases for nothing, and they're very interested in it, and we're going to have a public launch, or we're working on it at the moment, we're having a public launch of this, introducing it to the legal profession on the 7th of October. And the idea of this will be to extend legal representation to small firms or to complainants who can't afford legal representation, by giving them access to people who practice in this area and have some expertise. The second objective is to bring in new lawyers to the system, because what we're going to be inviting various organizations, particularly organizations like the BLA and people who represent lawyers who are underrepresented in this particular area, and saying, here's an opportunity for other practitioners to get into this area who can't break in. You can do some pro amico work through the system, get some expertise, get a reputation, and hopefully next time you do some work, it'll be paying work. So it has two objectives. One is to extend the nature of practitioners in this area, and secondly, to provide legal representation to people who don't have that representation, and so that they can get access to justice in that system. There is a third objective, but that very much depends on the attitude of the commission. But the one thing that we're suggesting to them is that these practitioners could also help them in screening the complaints that they're getting. Because one of the issues that you as the committee identified this morning was that there's a large number of complaints that the commission is getting, and it only prosecutes a very small fraction of them. So it's spending time assessing those complaints. And one of the things these practitioners could do once they get trained up is to actually assist the commission identify which cases have got possibilities and which don't. So in other words, you could refer a person bringing a complaint saying, look, before you come to us, go to pro bono and they'll get somebody to give you legal advice, and they can assess whether you've got a competition case or not and whether it's worthwhile doing. So that's another possible area for this project to help us help out the system. The next item is the case document management and performance information software. We have spent quite a lot of time this year engaging with a large public tender, which has now been awarded, engaging firms to provide us with a system which will enable us to manage our existing case document system, but also give us information about what's going on and all sorts of different issues that we want about our cases, and which you as the committee are interested in, which the ED are interested in, about information that's going into that system. And so having the right software and organizing correctly can provide quite a lot of information that we've got that just sits in files and not being properly assessed. So we are working at the moment with these people and saying, what type of information do we want out of the system? What will it tell us about our own performance? And what will it tell us about the performance as of the system as a whole? And so we are identifying information that we can plug in relation to each case, which will then be aggregated and can be extracted. So some of the questions that you're asking this morning about how long are cases taken, where is this being held up, are things that we can monitor through the system once it gets set up. So it's a big exercise to actually have got this thing done. I mean, it turned out to be much more ambitious a project than we thought it might be, because it's much more complicated. But we're using a software that's been used in some courts in the U.S. has not yet been used in this country, so it's a first-time experiment for us. But looks very exciting. Will hopefully help us identify a lot more information, a lot richer information, and so all sorts of different ideas are coming about what information might be viable. For instance, we might want to say, what sort of turnover is affected by mergers? What sort of turnover is affected by a prohibited practice case in the chemical industry? So you can see how valuable was it to do that particular case? What turnover was behind it if you then found a cartel? There was a cartel found in the bread industry. What total turnover was represented by that? What turnover has been represented by cartels in the food industry? Because that tells us about how significant are those cases? Are they worth taking on? If each cartel is arguably costing 10% more to consumers than it needed to be, what figure could we aggregate from that? And that's the sense, when you were asking about what's the impact this morning, this kind of information can be put into the system and got out. So obviously it's going to be a lot of work plugging into that information, but it can give us quite a lot of useful thing, which will help both ourselves, both the ED and both yourselves in terms of policy planning. Then we also at the same time trying to, a related product is improve our website. We want our website to be much friendlier than it is at the moment. And we want people who know nothing about our system to be able to go on our website and find out what's going on. And also to be a bit newsy. So if you don't, you're not necessarily having to be a litigant going to our website. You just want to find out what's going on. is it a useful source of information? At the moment, our website is fairly traditional, fairly boring, quite frankly, and so we're trying to, we're working on a project to improve that substantially. Finally, we're looking at internships. Again, the Commission has talked about internships. We've got a much more modest internship program because we're a much smaller organization. But we've got a relationship, we did a relationship with Pretoria University, and they are going to place students with us for a few weeks each year, so they get a feel for the institution during their vac. And we've also taken on our own interns during their vac, so somebody gets an experience with working within an organization. So it's fairly modest because we're a small organization. We're not talking about huge numbers of people, but we're talking about, you know, two or three people a year in within the organization getting some quite hands-on experience and helping them, no doubt, get into the job market earlier. Just on the subject of internship, while I mentioned that, you asked the Commission about what happens to their interns once they have finished with the Commission. I'm happy to say that a number of the Commission's interns end up working for the Commission, for the Competition Tribunal. And, you know, that's been quite useful because they've been identified people who are useful. When we've had vacancies, we've turned to them as our first port of call, and at least three in the last couple of years have come across to the Tribunal and been employed as case managers. And vice versa, some of our case managers, after a couple of years, have actually gone over to the Commission and taken more senior positions there. So there's quite a healthy cross-flow of skills that have remained in the public sector between the two organisations. Janine is going to just take you through then our budget slides that come up now.
Okay, there are two slides which kind of give you some information on the budget. The first one is covering the three-year budget over the current MTF period, beginning in 2010, 2011, and ending in 2012, 2013. And you'll see that our budget is substantially smaller than the Commission's. It's on average around 27, 28 million a year. And we currently have a grant committed via the EDD over the next three-year period that ranges from between 13 to 15 or almost 16 million. And our other income comes from filing fees, which are paid via the Commission for firms that have to pay filing fees for mergers and acquisitions when they lodged with the Commission. And we are currently in the situation with accumulated surpluses, which have been generated over the years of the Tribunal's operation, not because of underspending, but more because of the amount of money we initially generated in the beginning of the Tribunal's institution from filing fees before the thresholds were changed. And we have engaged with the EDD and the Treasury around the use of these accumulated surpluses over the next 3 years to fund our budgeted shortfall, because when we've submitted our budgets and business plans, we've indicated to them the level of budget that we require, and they are not in a position to increase the grant, but they have in a sense allowed us to draw down our accumulated surpluses over the next 3 years so that our funding is covered. From 2013, 2014, we'll need to engage more fully with EDD, and hopefully before then, around increasing the grant, because we anticipate that our surpluses will have been exhausted at that point. The next slide, Norman, I think if you can move on to it, deals with a breakdown of the current budget. And you'll see that the majority of our expenses goes on personnel, with 51.37% of our budget being allocated to personnel expenses. You'll also see at the bottom there the appeal court budget, which is about 2.74% of our budget. At the moment, we play an administrative role for the appeal court and administer the funds for them. And so that's what makes up that portion. Capital expenditure in this particular budget this year and over the next maybe 1 to 2 years is higher than it would normally be, because we're taking into account the development of that case document management system Norman spoke about, both in terms of the initial development costs and then support costs going forward, and perhaps some hardware costs associated with the need for increased servers and printing capacity. I think the rest of our budget is fairly straightforward. Professional services relates mainly to costs associated with the use of the building that we have at present, which is paid as a unitary payment to the Department of Trade and Industry, and then we share some facilities with the Commission, and that takes up some of that professional services plus any of the professional fees associated with some of the tribunal hearings expenses, like recording, transcription services. And I think that's all on the budget. So Norman, you can move to the...
These are the key issues facing us in the future. The first is the expediting case hearings, and we've spoken about that and what we can do about that. Second is quality of decisions, to ensure that decisions retain the quality they've had in the past. Integrating our case development, our case management system, and finally ensuring that we have staff development. Let me just deal with the one that I haven't dealt with, staff development. If I can just digress slightly, just to explain a bit of our workings, which I should have mentioned earlier, but I haven't, is how does the tribunal actually function? Because it's relevant to a number of things, including our budget. The tribunal functions in as an adjudicative body in having panels of three people make a decision. And we have 10 tribunal members, and of those tribunal members, three are full-time and seven are part-time. Each case has to be heard by three people. So what we do is typically, if it's a fairly straightforward matter, we will just have the three full-time members hearing the matter. But in matters that range in duration and complication, depending on our workload, we might have one or two or sometimes three part-time members on the panel. The budget consequences of those are that part-time members are only paid when they sit on matters. So it means that we run quite a lean and mean operation. And it explains why sometimes there are peaks and troughs in our expenditure, because the more we are using those part-time members, the more our sort of our variable costs are going up, and the less we use them, consequently they are going down. So the number of hearings days is it very much affects what our budget is, and I think I explained last time that's why it's very difficult for us to actually consistently be able to budget reliably, because it very much depends on how many cases are we going to have, and of those cases how many part-timers will sit, because they are a variable cost in our expenditure. The three part-timers are paid their salaries anyway, so that's not a variable cost. Now, the rest of our staff are full-time staff members, and we have a staff complement other than the three full-time members, a staff complement of 14 people, amongst them obviously Janine over here. And our staff complement is divided into three departments. We have a finance department, which Janine heads. We have a registry department headed by Larota Motuan, who has been here on a previous occasion. And then our case managers, the people who work with each panel, is by Resty Badenhorst. And that's where our staff is divided up. What we didn't do is the organogram, which we apologize for and should have been done, but if I could just give you the breakdown of the stats that you were interested in, just for your information this afternoon, we'll send you the organogram later. Amongst our staff, the 14 people, that exclude the tribunal members, there are 9 black staff and 5 white staff. On the gender breakdown, there are 2 males and there are 12 females. Amongst the tribunal members themselves, that's the 10 tribunal members, there are 6 black members and there are 4 white members. Amongst the executive team, which comprises both of the two of the full-time tribunal members and 3 of our staff, that's an executive 5. The position is there are 4 women and 1 male, and there are 3 white people and 2 black people on the executive committee. So those are our sort of race and gender breakdowns for our various categories of people. In relation then how does that fit into staff development? Well, it means that staff development should distinguish between the tribunal members, between the full-time and part-time tribunal members, and between our staff. Now, our tribunal members and our case managers are people who deal with the merits of our cases. So the kind of training that we sent them on is to get a knowledge of the legal and the economic issues involved in competition cases, which frequently involves sending people to overseas conferences to get that training, and also to have our own internal training program, which we have once a year. And this year we're going to have it in, next year we'll have it in February, and we'll invite two overseas speakers to speak to our tribunal members and our case managers. Our staff themselves, who are not case managers and not tribunal members, receive other training which is relevant to their experience, whether you're dealing with financial work, if you're dealing with risk management, or if you're dealing with, say, the case management. We find relevant training for them in that regard. So that's, on that note, let me, that's the end of our presentation then.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manon. I think we have an idea of what the strategic focus of this of the tribunal is all about. Can we interact with the presentation? Thank you very much, and Ms. Lecker. Yes. Any question for clarity, comment? I'll note Madam Lyon, Dr. Rabi, Mr. Ngonyama. Any other? No. In that order, please.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Chair, mine is not a question, it's just not really a comment, just clarity for me to understand more or better. Mine is on slide 15, key issues facing the tribunal. The second bullet point, quality of decision. I just want to know, I just want the commissioner to elaborate more on it, and elaborate more on it, and then thereafter I will maybe asking a question. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to, I've got two short questions. Your internships, you say you provide for internships. How long does it last, and what is the requirement of an internship? And do you employ these people, or what are they? I mean, they're the long-term prospects, please, Madam Chair, Mr. Monum, and then something else, which I said there. Your turnaround times regarding prohibited practices. You say you've got 20 days and you've got 100 business days. Is this in line with international best practice, or have you, I'd just like to get why are these particular time dates set? Is it based on the international model or not? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, the model is starting from where Dr. Rabi ended. It's in slide 10 and 11. The mine is, it's around the actual operation process. I'm a bit lost. When we talk about hearing set down within 10 business days of referral, is 10 days maximum, and that's one. Number two, are we counting about cases that have been referred by the competition directly to the tribunal? That's it. And what do you mean by orders issued within 10 business days of hearing, by orders? The other one is the written reasons for decisions provided within 20 business. What reasons? Is it reasons for taking particular and sort of a position or a judgment, and then we give that reason back to the, it's a feedback to the company, or it's a feedback to the commission. The pre-hearing requested, if you can just elaborate more on that, and pre-hearing requested of or by parties within 20 business days, this pre-hearing, I just want to understand the actual operation I was a bit lost there. Another very, very interesting one is slide 12 on the pro bono companies. I think you said pro bono companies for on this project called the Access to Justice. Now, whom are we referring to here as clients? Are we referring to companies, or are we referring to? Because I would imagine that companies have got the means to pay. And why is it that they would request and maybe to get access without paying, even if that payment was to be deferred and for them to pay later? And but some kind of a money. My last one is English, basically. I just like the term. You spoke about pro amico, something like that. There's a term like that. I just want you to explain to me. I just want to write it in English to increase my vocabulary.
Thanks,
Tembo Nyana.
Right. I think I also have a few questions. Preparations for practice guidelines. There's something that you mentioned there related to not wanting to allow before, that is before you issue orders, an illegal representation. Did I hear you right? I didn't. Okay, then it's fine. I thought I heard you saying that. I wanted to ask the question. You clarify. Okay. No, I didn't ask the question. I was just clarifying what he said, whether I heard him correctly. The first question then would be around your internship. I think Dr. Ravi did ask you questions. But I want to understand, why did you only make arrangements with the University of Pretoria? Why not other universities? I would actually like you to give us a synopsis of what the internship program looks like within your institution, within the entity actually. When did you start with the program? Ever since you started, how many have been retained? How many have been trained? Those who have been retained, can you also separate them by, categorize them by gender, race, and level of qualification? And where are they retained mostly? In which area? And the level of growth, you know, the mobility within, ever since they started. You're saying how long is your internship program? How long does it run within the department? Your main cost driver, compensation of personnel, which is, I think is quite clear and okay. But then you spend a lot of money also around professional services. I did hear you saying something about the building, longing to trade and industry, where you're sharing and so forth. I just want to understand it further, what you mean by that. And you're clubbing that with the money for recordings and transcripts and so forth. Why is it clubbed under professional services and not goods and services, for instance? Is it... I just want to understand that your third highest, actually that was your third, your second highest cost driver is the capital. Can you just tell us what is it all about? And I'm impressed that you're spending a lot of money on training, which is good, quite good, because most of institutions do not invest in their human resource development, which is which then tends to undermine even the very potential of the internal, you know, staff. The recruitment, can I understand, because in as far as your other information that I thought perhaps it will be explained thoroughly in your budget here, it's not clear. You are saying you're spending something like 11,000 or 110, oh, okay, 110,000 on recruitment. Can you elaborate further on that? I just want to understand what is it all about, what do you mean by recruitment, and 0.40% around that. I hope there are no afterthoughts for those who haven't said anything. Let's allow them the tribunal to respond.
Thanks very much, Chef. I feel in the order that they were asked. The question about the quality of decisions.
My one last question. Sorry about that. You have a grant that you're receiving. Is it from the DTI? Because there's somewhere here where you're saying this is a grant from DTI and it has a record, I mean, from 2000 and I think it's 2008 and 9 financial years and so forth. And you're still also projecting going forward, getting that particular grant. Can you clarify that grant vis-a-vis where you are positioned now, vis-a-vis the thing? And what is it for? And why is it not forming part of your total budget? Because I thought your total budget, in terms of what the figures that you've given us, you said is 27.4 million, is it? And it is not inclusive of that grant. If you can just explain so that I can understand it. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. The first question is what we meant by quality of decisions. I think the singular most important thing that we do is make decisions, and it's important that those decisions justify what we've done and explain to people what you can do and what you can't do very clearly, and where we've made decisions that differ from past decisions, explain why we are making a difference. So it's important. The most important way of communicating people the difference between right and wrong and justifying action taken, or when we don't take action, justifying non-action, is the quality of our decisions. So it's important that we write high-quality decisions and they're well-reasoned. And so I think we've got a good record in that historically. It's important that we keep that up. It's also important that more people within our, decisions tend to be largely written by the full-time members. It's important that our part-timers start to write more decisions and are enabled to write those decisions. But on the other hand, we must keep that quality up. So it's important, it measures up with part of our training. We must expose more of our newer members to training so that they can write more of the decisions. But we must keep up the quality of our decisions, but that's the most important thing that we contribute to the whole system. So that's why it remains an ongoing challenge for us. And because members are appointed for 5-year terms only, there is a change every 5 years, not wholly, but partially in the composition of our members. Some people with experience have left. So, for instance, we have lost David Lewis, our chair, and Maruma Marani, our deputy chair, left since our last appointments were, since our most recent appointments were done in 2009, few new people came on, so we've got to keep, as it were, keep the expertise within the system, and that's a challenge for us to keep that ongoing, because we tend to lose experienced people every time there's a new appointment, because people only serve for 5 years, they're not there on a more permanent basis, and that's why I situate it as an ongoing challenge for us. There were a number of questions around then our internship. Our internship system is very new, and it's only been going we're only in our second year now. We started off with Pretoria University because they actually came to us with a proposal, and so they were ready to do so, were ready to present students, and also matters of convenience, because we're located in Pretoria, those students are nearer by the institution. I don't think we have a closed door to getting other universities involved if they want to and if they're able to do so. But at the moment, we're still in a pilot phase. We're trying to see that we are doing it well and we're adding some value to their system. Because we're such a small organization, we haven't got enough people who can supervise those students during the time period. So we want to start off slightly small, and if it justifies it, we'll expand the system to include other people. At the moment, students are with us for 3 to 4 weeks in the mid-year, and might be available for a week or two later in the year. We don't pay them; they come there at their own expense. They're not paid to anything, and we don't have to have any ongoing employment relationship, because they're still law students. They haven't yet finished. They need to finish their qualifications. So sometimes they are final year law students and will be looking for a job in the following year. Sometimes they're in an intermediate year and so going to the university for the next year. At this stage, because it's so new, we can't. Although we are following people, what happens to them, we haven't got a sort of trend as to what the outcomes were. Ideally, if a person was interested in competition law, they might, in the following year, apply as a full-time intern with a commission which offers full-time internships. That might be a nice way of doing it, but it's still too young at the moment. As far as the gender, the other, we also got someone just to come in and do some administrative work in our office, who was a student, university student, and just did some administrative work, and it worked out quite well, and it's something that we're going to repeat because it worked well. And that's, we can also repeat at the same time during university vacations when these people are available. So far, three people have been through the system. All people have been, all three have been black students, and the gender, there have been two women and one man. And in fact, two of the people have actually been students from other parts of, who were studying at University of Pretoria, but one was from Nigeria and one was from Botswana, and hopefully they will take that experience back home with them and maybe get involved in the competition authorities there. But we don't, it's up to University of Pretoria who selects them. They know our criteria, they understand our program, but they do the selection because they're dealing with our students all the time. Then I wanted to get on to the time periods, and the question was asked, why these particular time periods and what are they based on? Well, let me deal with mergers. The merger time period is actually set up in our rules. So it says from the time that the commission brings you its report, you must hear the matter within 10 days or have what is called a pre-hearing conference. When might we do one or the other? If the matter is uncomplicated, we will actually hear the merger within 10 business days of it getting referred to us by the commission. And in fact, most mergers are done in that way. If, however, it's complicated because the commission has recommended a prohibition, because the commission's report has a conclusion. It says either approve the merger, approve it with conditions, or prohibit it. So if there's some, the commission has prohibited it or recommended conditions that the parties aren't agreeable to, or if it emerges from the commission's report that there is a third party unhappy with the merger, we will probably have a pre-hearing. Now, we ask what a pre-hearing is. A pre-hearing is really a management meeting of the case. And we say, okay, these are the issues in this case. When can we hear the case? How long will it take to hear the case? Because you can't decide when you're going to hear it until you know how long it's going to be. What are the issues? Are there going to be witness statements? Is there going to be what is called discovery, which is when the parties are called upon to produce documents relevant to that? So it's a kind of nuts and bolts management meeting of a hearing. So in a merger case, we will either have a pre-hearing within 10 business days or the hearing itself. Then we were asked in relation to the time period where do we, in relation to previous practices, where do we get this 100 days from? Is this a sort of figure in best practice? We can't find figures of best practices. They don't seem to track them in other jurisdictions, partially because in other jurisdictions they actually go to the courts, and the courts themselves don't keep those figures. So it's really been based on a large number of our cases and a feel for where that figure might lie. But it's South African-based rather than externally based. And also on a feel for what a high court might decide, make a decision in terms of a more complex hearing with lots of paper. Then we were asked what the different meaning was between the order and between our reasons. Our order is really the conclusion. Do we prohibit the merger? Do we prohibit with condition? Do we approve it or approve it with conditions? That's all the order says, just one page saying that. The reasons are the justification. In other words, we say the reason we approved this merger is that there were no overlaps between these firms. And the reasons usually run to about five pages, but in some complicated mergers, like the merger of Sasol and Engen, which we did a few years ago and we prohibited, the decision ran to over 100 pages long, and it was very, very complicated to do, and actually took us considerably longer than 20 business days to actually get that decision out. We then asked, what is your audience for your reasons? In other words, are you addressing it the commission or the particular firms or it's somebody else? And I think the answer is probably all three. Sometimes we are saying to the commission, you needed to have taken this into account, and then our reasons will address that. Sometimes we'll be saying to the firms a particular message as well, and sometimes it'll be just for the guidance of the general public. But it's part of broadly a climate of justification. If you make a decision, you should justify why you do it. So somebody could say, why did the commission allow this merger between these two, the tribunal permit these mergers between these two banks to go ahead? What were their reasons? And somebody can go to our website, press the reasons and find that. And so hopefully people will think that government is transparent and justifies its reasons for doing so. So I think we've got all those people are really the audience for the decisions, and when we explain them, we must hopefully meet all their expectations. Then we were asked about pro amico, what does it mean? Pro amico means it's sort of Latin for a friend, which basically means that lawyers act for free, which is something they don't do often and do so reluctantly. Sometimes people use the word pro bono, which is for the good. But basically it means that they will be provided free representation. So we asked them, if you're providing free representation and these people are companies, why can't they pay themselves? This will really be for the circumstances where you've got often small businesses and small firms are complainants. Or it could be a group of consumers who are worried about a merger and want to get involved in that. But we've had a number of cases where small businesses have not been able to afford representation, and people have to represent themselves against the whole phalanx of lawyers and economists. One fellow did quite well in one case. He succeeded before us, but the appeal court set our decision aside. But there are those people, and they keep phoning up our registry and saying, look, I want to bring this case. I cannot afford the kind of legal fees that are involved in this thing. Can you help me? Because the legal expenses are extraordinarily expensive. I'm shocked when I see what these costs are. And even a reasonable-sized business put into a case like that it has to oppose simply could not afford this. Only very, very big business can actually, or a government institution, can actually afford this kind of litigation. And just to give you an example, I'll be discussing the SA Breweries case when we do the quarterly report. It's a case the Commission has brought against South African breweries. The Commission, despite its public resources, has a legal team, an economics team, which is half the size the SA Breweries can bring to that particular case. So you can imagine how difficult it is for a private party with no public funding to actually bring one of these cases. So that's why this pro bono thing is quite important. And hopefully what we want to do is that some of these big law firms who've made lots of money acting in other cases will, for the good, as it were, bring one of these cases. Because part of the Justice Department's program is to get law firms to do much more pro bono work as part of their corporate responsibility. And what law firms like to do is a case in an area that they know about. So we think that's going to be quite attractive to these firms, and it's also a way of getting their younger lawyers involved in the case. Then I think, if I could just clarify, sorry, what I said about the guidelines about the lawyers, and I think I didn't make that very clear. I said we would say to people, look, if you can't, we're setting this case down in 3 months, if your existing legal team is not available, you must find somebody else. They won't be without representation, but there's no reason for them to say, I have to have Mr. Jones or Mr. Kamalo as my lawyer, and he's even involved so far. This is what always happens with lawyers. And now, what the High Court's doing and what we want to do is saying, look, you've got 3 months to get somebody, you'll find somebody else, there are plenty of lawyers around. We're not going to wait for this specific lawyer diary to be conveniently opened, but they will certainly be allowed to be represented.
Okay, the questions regarding the finance, I think if I start with the first one, recruitment, that is a budget figure where we take 2% of the annual secretariat salary, so the salaries of all the staff excluding the tribunal members, and it's purely a budget figure provided in case we have to recruit additional staff and we have to use an outside recruitment agency to assist us with it, and then also the cost of placing an advert in a newspaper, because those cost between 25 to 30,000. So it would roughly be the cost associated with the recruitment of two new employees if we had to employ two new employees during the year if we had unexpected resignations. Then with regard to the professional fees, in our budget categories, we've put the fees paid to outside firms for transcription recording as part of our professional services expenses, mainly I think because it related to outside consultants, and we tend to rotate those through a number of service providers depending on what their service is. But the professional services fees is made up of expenses that are paid or costs that are paid to the Competition Commission for shared services, to the DTI for occupation. We are located on the campus that was built by the DTI for all the DTI COTI institutions, and they charge a unitary payment to each of those institutions based on the space that they occupy, and that's what that cost is. And then it covers other costs like bank charges, legal fees, which is purely a budget figure that we provide in the event that we have to resort to any legal advice related to any of our particular cases. Some outside consulting services that could be related to software that we use, or alternatively for management consulting, development of policies or assistance and other issues, and then the transcription services, and then the audit committee and internal and external audit fees, which those alone, the three of those, the audit associated with the audit, cost in the region of about R1 million. The recording services, we budgeted about just over 500,000 this year for those costs. But those would vary depending on the number of cases we have during a particular year. Then with regard to the facilities and capital, as I said, over the next 3 years, a fair amount of those costs, the costs that we anticipate would be associated with the development of the case document management and performance information software. We may find we spend less than we budgeted, but for this particular year, we budgeted $3 million for that particular item, with $2 million being for the software development itself, another $500,000 for support, and $500,000 for expected hardware costs. We are currently now in the process of working out what hardware is required, and we may find that we spend less than that $500,000. And also the ongoing support may be less than $500,000 for this year and going forward. The other costs are all minor. We had, all less than $500,000, which are related to the purchase of a new motor vehicle, which we use, and then depreciation, some leasing of printing and photocopying machines, and then about $400,000 for replacement of computers and other minor assets this particular year. That will also vary year on year. We tend to replace our computers every 3 years. And then you asked the question about the grant. If you go back to my slide on page 13, that grant is what historically would have been granted by the DTI and then was transferred to the EDD when we transferred the functions. And so that, of our budget, 27.41 million, in this particular year. We're going to get 13.63 million from the EDD. 5.76 million is our anticipated filing fees and interest income. The expected shortfall is 8.02 million, which we're going to make use of our accumulated surplus for. So going forward, the departmental grant is that second column, 13.63, 15.18, and 15.6 over the next MTF period. So I think that deals with all the questions, the particular financial questions that you asked.
Thank you very much. There are follow-up questions? Ma'am Lyon, Mr. Nguyen.
Thank you, Chair. I think that for me, asking that question, it was mainly because of the difficulty in reading this the slide. Because when you look at key issues facing the tribunal, for me, it's the challenges. So when you put quality of decisions in here, when I read it, it came to mind that something went wrong somehow. So I think if that's not the case in the way that you explained, you must just rephrase it so that it's easier for one when we read through it to understand it. Thank you.
The appeal process from the what is the, if you can just give us a glimpse of on the appeal process. The other one is the filing fee. Just for us to understand what is the filing fee.
Let me start with the filing fees. In merger cases, there is a very high fee for the merging parties to pay when they file these mergers, and there is, I don't have those figures at hand, because they actually pay the commission directly, not us, and then we just get a percentage of that. But there is a different fee for intermediate mergers and for large mergers, the fee being higher for large mergers. There's a fairly high fee for that in merger cases. In relation to prohibitive practice cases, the fee is nominal, I think it's 100 Rand to get your revenue stamps to start the case. So the majority of those fees are from merger cases, and we have a formula which we share those fees with the commission, that we have an agreement about how we divide those fees, but they pay to the commission. We can get you, I don't have that information at hand, but we can give you what those figures are. They're fairly high there.
The legislated fees?
In the rules, yeah.
No, I don't know them offhand.
Okay. In relation to the appeal system, there are three appeals from tribunal decisions if a case travels that far. There is an appeal, automatic appeal to the Competition Appeal Court. There's then an appeal with leave to appeal from the Competition Appeal Court to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And at the present moment, if it raises a constitutional issue, there's a further appeal from them to the Constitutional Court, all of which puts more time on cases. Now, one of the things that we've made representations on recently is to do with the Superior Courts Bill, because the Superior Courts Bill is taking the Competition Appeal Court out of our legislation and putting it into the Superior Courts Bill as one of their specialist courts. But we and the Judge President, Judge Davis, who's Judge President of our Appeal Court, have made representations to somehow either cut the Supreme Court of Appeal out or to reduce the number of cases that would go there, make it a higher threshold. And we made representations to Justice, and we await a response to that. But when the committee was considering what things it may possibly do, this may be an area that you're interested in. What we can do is I could send you both our representations and the Judge President's representation, so you can see what we're saying about that. But we've gathered statistics which show that the appeal from the Competition Appeal Court to the Supreme Court of Appeal adds at least another 13 months to the life of the case, and sometimes can be even longer, because there haven't been that many cases which have gone to the Supreme Court of Appeal, but where they've gone that route, they've taken an enormously long time. And so our proposal is basically that one, because under the new system, the Constitutional Court is not limiting itself to constitutional issues, but is widening its ambit. There's no reason to have three shots at an appeal. And all it serves is to allow an incumbent firm with plenty of money to play that system each time, even if it's refused leave to appeal, it applies for a petition, etc., etc., and you can keep playing that system. If you owe a fine, or you think a fine is coming, it frankly pays you to keep playing the system. So if we can at least exclude the Supreme Court of Appeal from the system, if the Constitutional Court's ambit is widened, then that would seem to be leaving people with two courses of appeal, one a specific appeal on the facts and direct law from the Competition Appeal Court, and for that rarer case where there's a more important principle at stake, you go to the Constitutional Court now with its expanded mandate. But to go to three courts is ridiculous. Very, very few systems elsewhere operate like this. And because you're up against well-managed firms when you've got competition law cases with huge amounts at stake, because you're trying to tell people to change a business practice that is making them a lot of money. You can imagine if it is a case where somebody has a monopoly or it looks like a monopoly, you know, why should they ever concede in the system? Why not keep paying it? As long as your payment of legal fees dwarfs what you have to pay out, should there be a remedy against you, you will continue appealing. So it's an area of concern, and perhaps something that the committee might want to consider with your colleagues on the Justice Portfolio Committee once they start looking at that legislation. Because the real concern of ours, and it contributes to why cases are taking so long once they've left, as it were, the commission and the tribunal. So that's basically where we stand on the appeal system, and it's a fairly bleak thing. It's not to say that we have a monopoly on knowledge in the tribunal, for it to excuse the inappropriate pun, but you know, having three shots at an appeal is really excessive. You know, having one specific appeal and one appeal on more general principle would seem adequate. And given that the Constitutional Court's remit is now widening, it would be an appropriate time to actually remove the Supreme Court of Appeal. And in fact, if you read the Competition Act, the Competition Appeal Court was meant to be final on all matters except constitutional matters. That's how we drafted the statute. But the Supreme Court of Appeal considered a case and said that this was unconstitutional, that provision. They had to have the final say over all these particular cases.
On the question of the appeal, that the tribunal is saying that they can actually share some thoughts on this with us. I'm sure, Madam Chair, that will be empowering to us, so that if need be, we can take up the matter first amongst ourselves to look at the appropriateness of the proposal with regard to these three shots on appeal, and maybe pilot it and a debate in the House, and to try and shorten up this period. And I think that's the whole idea. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Mbonyama. And to the tribunal for the responses. I realize that there hasn't been any money brought forward from the previous financial year. And you're not anticipating any balance in your balance sheet.
No, there is a short. There's a small accumulated surplus that we're bringing forward when you see our annual report for the current financial year, the one that ended March 2010, of about 1.5 million. But we've got, as I've said before, those accumulated surpluses that are sitting in the corporate the public deposits, which we have engaged with Treasury and the EDD about accumulating. They've given us permission in the previous financial year to retain 19 million of that, and we just need to ask them to retain the next 1.5, but only for funding the shortfall on the budget going over for the next 3 years. so that we won't be asking EDD for more money, because we've got that that accumulated surplus to fund our shortfall that was shown, I think, slide 15.
Okay, because I'm also referring to this document.
Which page, yeah?
The last page. Appendix C. I realize there are a few documents here. So it's important that perhaps you update.
In this one. The reason for that is that normally we don't, we're not supposed to put the budget, the balance board forward in there until we've got the permission from them. So it's reflected in the committed grant, and then that should now change to DTI/EDD because it was historic.
Mm.
It would be anticipated in that additional grant required. There's the committed amount and then the additional grant required. But I'll reword it so that you can see. But it's not put. Once we do the actual, then we put it forward as a balance board forward. But until they've given us permission, we've left it there as additional grant. But I'll make the revisions on that.
Okay, because it doesn't give the correct reflection. Because I'm looking at the figures here on the page 13.
I think that.
Yeah.
The problem also is that when we submit our budgets to Treasury and to the department, we're not allowed to budget for a surplus or deficit. So our budget is balanced off by showing the additional funds that are required for one particular year, and then the cash and cash equivalents is drawn down on the MTF schedule. So it's taken into account what we need to balance our budget for a particular year, taken into account in that top line item of grant required. But we can reword it with notes to explain it.
That's why I was asking a question whether that grant is incorporated or not.
Yeah.
And it is important, since you were granted the permission to get that money from the national kit.
Yeah.
That you also include it as part of, so that it gives us the correct reflection.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. We'll revise it and get it one going forward.
All right. You know, as you give us the presentation, it should reflect what is in the broader document, so that we have one and the same thing. We don't, you know, ask questions. Because this must just summarize what is here, so that if we want further information, we can be able to get it. And when you're the meeting still continues. You still have the quarterly report to deal with. Yes. Otherwise, thank you very much. We will really follow up on this appeal process issue. As Mr. Ngonyama indicated, I think it will only be good for us to get that information. But the pro bono, pro amigo, is it amigo or amico?
Amigo.
Amigo. Oh, CO. Okay. I would also want us to understand it, the concept, to understand that concept better, because it's something that would also bring about questions going forward. How do you, because there are in normal course, you know, where people do not have sufficient money, and the legal aid courts are not able to, or legal aid are not able to assist because their budgets are not sufficient and so forth. And here we have businesses that have money and we want to assist. Those debates, I think we want to discuss it even further, the model itself, if we can be given that opportunity to do so, maybe in the coming, in our coming meetings. Otherwise, We welcome this software, the case document management, and and performance information software, because it's going to make your work easy and it's going to make us understand things even much more, especially when we need information. It's not going to be difficult for us to get that information. Thank you very much for the presentation and the responses we received. I think we are clear. We are not legal people, but you made us understand, you know, even the legal terms that you use, some of them, use them with the plain English that we would understand. Thank you very much. May we then, I thought I was closing them line on this. So we're coming to the quarterly report. Can you wait a bit and perhaps park that question if or comment to that the next session? It won't fit. Oh. Okay. Let's continue. Members will go and service themselves in the process.
Yes.
I'm told there's coffee out and tea outside. If you want, please do so. Because I know many members will be coming with a request to be excused for a few minutes or so, or to attend other commitments. Let's make sure that, because I don't think this is going to be very long. Can we then save time by grabbing a cup of tea or coffee while the tribunal continues with the quarterly report? Unless you want a break.
When you have to. You can.
No, I don't want to. To rob you of that opportunity. If you feel you need to drink water, some break for to drink water, we can break for 2 minutes just to allow you to get some breath. It's fine. Okay. 2 minutes, strictly 2 minutes. Mr. Ngonyama, we do understand. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be even briefer with this, Chair. The first slide just represents the cases that we had in this quarter. You'll notice that the matters received always exceed the matters heard. That's simply because the matter isn't always isn't heard on the same day that it comes in. So that explains why there are more matters received than heard during that quarter. So the balance will be heard in the next quarter. So we are just reflecting the different kinds of cases: large mergers, intermediate mergers. Let me just explain interim relief, which is the third item, with the word that we haven't used so far. What happens is that prohibited practice cases, because they take so long and can take years to resolve, there is a procedure under the Act in which the complainant who brought that complaint can apply for what is called interim relief. That is, the firm can come along and say, look, until this case is resolved, please give me interim relief on this basis. And we're allowed to, if they can persuade us to do that, to give interim relief for up to 6 months. Now, the problem with interim relief is that it's all done on papers as opposed to witnesses, so you need to present a case that is fairly uncomplicated and relief that can be reversed just in case the final case goes against them. So it makes interim relief tricky to give and not always appropriate to every case. So it's rare that there are interim relief cases, but in this particular quarter we heard one interim relief case, and one case the person succeeded, but it was appealed and we were reversed on appeal. The other case, the interim relief case, was heard in the next quarter and they were not successful. The complaint referral figures of four that we heard were all consent orders, and consent orders again are prohibited practice cases which the commission starts and then enters to a plea bargain, in other words a deal with the respondent, and it's brought to us as a deal between the commission and the respondent, and we must then decide whether it's appropriate. If it's appropriate, we will approve it and become an order. So in other words, the commission can't ever settle a case privately on its own. We are there, as it were, the guardians of the public interest, and all consent orders must be brought to us for approval, and in this particular quarter we heard four such matters. You'll see from the procedural figure that the bulk of the matters that we've heard have actually been procedural, and one might wonder why is that case. Why are we hearing procedural matters and not matters on the merits? Well, it's the nature of this kind of litigation that people raise procedural points against the Commission all the time, and we have to decide that. It looks quite gloomy from that point of view that we have to hear so many, but quite frequently if we resolve a procedural point in favour of the Commission against the respondent, people sometimes will settle. And there was one case we decided last year as a procedural point, and just in this particular quarter that same case has come back to us as a settlement agreement between the Commission and that party. It never went to trial. So quite often procedural points are tactical ploys by people to, as it were, soften up the Commission, and if they don't succeed, people will ultimately settle. But it's a necessary part of a just administrative system to hear them. So those are the cases that we've got. These are just some of the cases of note that occurred during that period. I know that we're running late, so I'm not going to sort of discuss them unless people have got particular questions about them. Two of them have already been mentioned by Sam Rambler of the Keystone Milling case, the Masana one he mentioned in his presentation this morning. I've mentioned that the case against South African Breweries is an ongoing piece of litigation not yet resolved, which relates to the South African Breweries distribution system. It ran for several weeks last month. It's going to carry on in October and will carry on in March next year. That's how long these cases can sometimes take to run. And the one time in Lanceria case, just for your interest, again was a procedural matter, but this relates to one time wanting to get access to Lanceria Airport, which has a agreement with Comair and Kalula, which one time says is exclusionary of it and prevents it going to Lanceria and flying from there. This is a case which the Commission did not refer. They brought this one themselves, so that's why it's an example of how that system works. The one important case we decided during that period was the Competition Commission and Tracetech and Netstar, which was basically related to a standard association had set which excluded rivals. In other words, they set a standard so high that no rival could get access to that, and we found against Tracetech, Netstar and Matrix had been responsible for that. That case again is on appeal. We'll see what happens with that. International networking, again, Commissioner Rambrath covered this, and we've been to the same conferences as they have, and I don't need to repeat that. Our strategic focus we've covered in the main report, and you'll just see them coming again as part of the focus in this quarter. Quarterly reports going forward, we're just saying that we need to realign the way we do our quarterly reports in line with the way the ED wants us, and to get the targets that I've mentioned to you earlier included in these quarterly reports. That's really all I have to say on those issues. The specific issues or issues around the cases you want to ask me more, please do so.
Thank you very much. That's quite short and precise report. There's a detailed report, I think, that you did get. Can we refer to that report as we ask questions? Ma'am, so did.
Yeah, thank you. In the presentation prior to this one, there's information that in as far as internships are concerned, you are new in the process, only take 2 or 3 per annum, and it appears again in your strategic focus. Do you intend to increase the number of the internships, and how?
We do intend to increase the internships. We want to have the same person come during another vacation, and also possibly to extend it to other universities as well, because at the moment it's just limited to the University of Pretoria.
Thank you. Just a quick question on the, with regards to the mergers. When they do happen, is it the case for the tribunal to look into each and every merger and whether it complies with the law or and the act, or is it what? You look into that when it is brought to your attention by anybody, you know, whether there may be a problem or not.
The way the our merger system works is that notification of mergers is compulsory for mergers over a certain turnover. And so if the turnover depends on the size of the acquiring firm, in other words, the firm that is buying control, and what we call the target firm, the firm is being bought. And if both are exceed a certain threshold of turnover or asset size, they have to be notified to the Competition Commission. So they are, it's compulsory notification, and they can't implement the merger until such time as it's been approved. Those figures of turnover change from time to time, because as inflation goes up, we raise those figures, and any merger that falls below those thresholds does not have to be notified. And technically speaking, a merger occurs when there is a change of control over a firm. In other words, any transaction that is less than a change of control does not have to be notified. But once it meets the definition, it has to be notified to the Commission. Now, if some mergers fall below a threshold for a large merger, and those mergers the Commission itself can approve without having to come back to us, and quite a lot of them are done in that way, and they're called intermediate mergers. We get involved when the merger is above a certain, the next threshold becomes called a large merger. But we rely on the Commission to do a report, an investigation first, and it looks both at the economic consequences of this merger. Is it going to lessen competition? And at the public interest. Is it going to be adverse to a public interest? For instance, employment is one of them. Generally speaking, for most of these mergers, when the Commission has done a report, we will hear that within 10 days, and we will approve it. And so it doesn't add a greater burden to that system. Sometimes, either because the matter is contested, or we have concerns that the Commission didn't have, the matter may take longer. But so we look at the competition. What is the effect on competition? Is the merger going to make the situation in the economy worse? I often say to students when I lecture to them, the purpose of merger control is like the vaccine of the system. It's to prevent the illness of monopoly occurring before it happens. The purpose of prohibited practice is like the antibiotics. The illness has already happened. You're trying to cure it with antibiotics. Vaccines are better than antibiotics. They're more powerful. So it's important that we have a merger control system, as it were, ex ante. But it does mean that it's a rather invasive system, and that we are hearing a lot of cases which, in fact, aren't going to cause problems. But that's the only way we can. We have to vaccinate the whole population, not just the people who might get ill. If I can be forgiven for stretching this medical analogy a bit further.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Professor.
I'm just trying to think about the second part of my question, the how part. Maybe just to try and simplify, it's a bit big. I'm just talking to myself. That if we're referring to a criteria, is that the students from Botswana and the other one, I don't know? Yeah. But now your target, like investing in the country, students are South African. Maybe to say out of five internships, three must be South African, just to invest in the country.
Look, I think it's an interesting issue. I know our minister feels that we should also be investing in people from other parts of Africa as well, and investing in their training as well. So I'm interested to hear views of the committee, but our feeling is that we should consider both. And if the university identifies an appropriate interested student from another part of Africa, and they can benefit from being ours and take that back home, that's part of our sort of broader obligation to the continent. So we've seen value there.
What she's trying to say, charity begins at home. Yeah, because you can't leave your children suffering and expect to really be helping children somewhere else, or investing a lot of money somewhere else, whereas your children. That's exactly the essence of what
yeah.
you're saying.
The comments
we say, we're not saying they should be excluded, but charity must begin here at home. I just want to find out the extent of this report and the summary here. I think this was over-summarized. Will you agree with me? And it sort of robbed us of really interrogating more, because you know, as I look into this document, the detailed document, it's talking of others, and I think it will be important that we read through this document and then later on come back to you, because it has a lot of information that can be used and that can be pursued with you further. And I think that the people who prepared it spent a lot of time preparing it, and we cannot just overlook it and just because I think it contains valuable information. There's one issue I wanted to clarify with you. At what stage should you give us the details of what these cases are all about? Because earlier on, we had the Competition Commission saying the committee must be able to assist in profiling some of these cases, you know, by bringing them out to the public, by challenging them, calling the relevant people to come and account to the committee, so that we run a parallel process. But it is important also that we get these cases, especially after the Competition Commission has referred them to yourself, or even those that you have, you feel they were not referrals, but you are dealing with them. Because I don't, ever since we interacted, we just get the headlines. These are the issues we are dealing with, they concern, then the elaboration will be as you present it, but the actuals in terms of the documentation we do not get. So I think if you can provide us with a summary of every case so that we can understand what all those cases are all about, and then decide. We will then decide as a committee which case warrants us calling, you know, people. We will weigh the cases ourselves and see whether we cannot assist in profiling them. Colleagues, unless there are any other questions, comments, or any input you would want to give, I'm giving you this opportunity now. If you want to make a political statement, do it now. Otherwise, colleagues, this should then bring us to the end of our interaction with the competition tribunal. I know after lunch is quite difficult to run a meeting because everybody feels tired, full, and they want to just relax. But unfortunately, we have to work. We will create time wherein we're going to be on our own discussing this, and if we feel there is any further information we need after our own discussions, we will, through our secretary, bring that to your attention. Otherwise, let's thank you very much for availing yourself, and we hope that the outstanding issues that we talked about, they will be provided. Yeah, members, on the 3rd, we will be considering IDC first plan and quarterly report, and we will appreciate if you can avail yourself. We have received few apologies so far, and then we'll assess whether we should continue with that meeting or postpone it, because we do need a quorum. Please make sure that you avail, because we did explain this, that we need to close the gap. We have backlogs in terms of the work that we have to do. So we have to really deal with the backlogs so that come end of September, we're done. We are ready for the annual report. So let's do so. If you can just sacrifice for this, work. Otherwise, thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned. Can we have the MC?